Oh yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session. Please adjourn.
Thank you. Be seated. The orders of the court are posted outside and in the clerk's office and available for your inspection. Three justices of the court are not here at this time for various reasons. However, they all will participate in the deliberations and decisions in these causes. There are three causes that have been set for oral argument this morning. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Cherokee Water Company versus Gregg County Appraisal District and Gregg County Appraisal Review Board from Gregg County. Luis S. Minton versus the Honorable Ray Perez, Judge, an original mandamus proceeding, and Eyesight Incorporated versus Joseph Blackburn and others from Harris County. The court in each of these causes has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument and 10 minutes for rebuttal. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these three oral arguments, but we will complete these proceedings before our noon break. Counsel in the second and third causes may leave the courtroom while earlier matters are being argued, but please remain nearby so that we can proceed to your matter without delay. Counsel in all causes are advised that these arguments are approved for the convenience of the court. If you would like to hear the tapes of the arguments, you may make application to do so with the clerk of our court. The court is now ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Cherokee Water Company versus Gregg County Appraisal District and Appraisal Review Board.
May it please the court, Mr. William Icard and Mr. William Fogarly present argument.
May it please the court, my name is Bill Eichert and I'm here this morning with my colleague Bill Kilgarland representing the petitioner Cherokee Water Company. Your honors, this is an ad valorem tax case. It involves excessive valuation. The case history is briefly that it covers the tax years 1982, 83, 85, and 86. It was tried to the bench, Judge Larry Starr in Gregg County in Longview. Upon the conclusion of the evidence, Judge Starr entered judgment for the plaintiff, Cherokee Water Company, in three of the years, 83, 85, and 86, and for the taxing authorities in 82. Cherokee Water Company appealed Judge Starr's decision in each of the years, alleging that with respect to 82, there was no authority on the part of the court to raise the value over that which was determined by the Appraisal Review Board, and with respect to the remaining 3 years, arguing that the value, while reduced by the court, was not reduced sufficiently to comply with the law. By way of an aside, I think it's important to inform the court that there is presently scheduled before Judge Starr a December 1990 trial setting of the 1987, 1988, and 1989 tax years for this exact same property involving the exact same dispute. We think, therefore, that it is important for the court to know that so that we can obtain the court's guidance by that trial setting with respect to its ruling on the disputes that have been made the basis of our application. With respect to this property tax suit, and it is first, I guess, most important to describe the property involved. The property is composed of several tracts out of a 7,100-acre tract of land owned by Cherokee Water Company, located in Gregg and in Rusk Counties, Texas. You have before you in the materials that we handed out a reproduction of the map that's on the easel under tab number one. That is the 7,100-acre tract. What is unique about this property is that it has been owned continuously and without interruption by Cherokee Water Company since 1950 for the purposes of providing water to the city of Longview. Located on the property, covering approximately 3,300 acres, is a freshwater reservoir known as Lake Cherokee. Also, what is unique about this property is that Cherokee Water Company's shareholders each lease a lot on the perimeter lakefront of Lake Cherokee, and on those lots that are located in most cases residential dwellings owned by the leaseholders. It's important for this court to know that Cherokee Water Company does not own those leasehold improvements. They are owned by the lessee shareholders. The taxes are paid by the lessee shareholders on those residential improvements, and the taxes in that as to those improvements are not in dispute in this case. With respect to the tax treatment of this property, it's important for the court to know that a portion of the property is located in Rusk County and a portion is located in Gregg County. Therefore, there is a separate appraisal of the property for tax purposes made by each the appraisal districts located in each of those counties. You can see on the handout under tab number one, depicted in color, the areas which are appraised by each of those appraisal districts. On the map, the area in green is appraised by the Rusk County Appraisal District alone. The area in red is appraised by the Gregg County Appraisal District alone. The area in orange is appraised by both appraisal districts by virtue of an anomaly. There is an overlapping taxing unit involved here which requires that Gregg County appraise a significant portion of this county, which is at this property, which is actually located in Rusk County. I point that up because I think it's important for you to know that, number one, Cherokee Water Company does not dispute the value assigned to its property by Rusk County Appraisal District. It has paid its taxes on that appraisal. It is also important, number two, to show to the court the difference between the appraisal positions taken by Rusk County and by Gregg County, because it shows that there is a portion that is appraised by both appraisal districts. Therefore, we can compare the respective values assigned to them. For example, in 1985, Rusk County Appraisal District appraised the area that is depicted in orange at approximately $500 an acre. The very same property was appraised by Gregg County Appraisal District in 1985 for approximately $6,400 an acre, a difference of approximately $6,000 an acre. Now, we have come forward in our application this morning, Your Honors, on three points of error. Because of the time limitations, we are going to discuss the first two. I'm going to devote my argument to point of error number one. Mr. Kilgarland, in the last 5 minutes of our opening remarks, will discuss point of error number two. Now, our point of error number one is a relatively simple and straightforward argument in a relatively unorthodox and complicated appraisal task. Our argument is that the legislature of the state of Texas has set out a blueprint by which all appraisals for tax purposes in Texas shall be conducted. This is a legislative mandate. And to the extent that any appraisal district, either during the initial appraisal process or during the protest and appeal process in a trial on a trial de novo, that blueprint must be followed. Failing to follow that blueprint constitutes an illegal appraisal, and if a trial court relies upon it, accepts it for the purposes of entering its judgment, it is committed reversible error. That is exactly what happened in this case, Your Honors. That blueprint is set out under Section 2301 of the tax code, which is on the easel next to the map. It is also found under tab number 3 on your handout. Among other things, the court can see that Section 2301B that says in express, clear, and unambiguous language that, however, each property shall be appraised based upon the individual characteristics that affect the property's market value. It is that language which brings us here today. The policy behind that language, I think, is fairly self-evident. It is not for the taxing authorities to conclude which encumbrances, which restrictions, which impediments to title, which contracts, if any, between the owner of the property and third parties which may affect its alienability are to be considered for appraisal purposes. In the exercise of generally accepted appraisal methodology, the appraiser must be and remain independent. He must be allowed to consider all material conditions affecting the property, his judgment, and more importantly, perhaps the judgment of the trier of fact, must be unfettered and must not be supplanted by the taxing authority. Now, you have before you, under tabs 4 and 5 of the handout, the express limiting conditions, both general and specific, which Mr. Norwood used in his appraisal. Now, the Gray County Appraisal District hired James Norwood to appraise the subject property and to testify as to his opinion of fair market value at trial. He was given certain instructions by the Gray County Appraisal District, and he himself imposed upon his appraisal certain assumptions, limiting conditions, and contingencies. By doing this, he failed to consider the size of the property, and he failed to consider the encumbrances burdening it. Both of these are individual characteristics which affect its value. Now,
Which way did they affect the value? I mean, do we know in the record?
Opinion testimony from our expert, which did take into consideration these factors, which results in a lower value, Your Honor. But the fact of the matter is, we don't know because he didn't even consider them. As far as these contingent and limiting conditions are concerned, let's look at them. First of all, you can see in the highlighted portion at the top of the general contingent and limiting conditions that the legal description and the size of the property was dictated by the client. He didn't consider the size. Number two, and perhaps mostly, the property was appraised as though it was free and clear of encumbrances. He didn't even consider whether there were any encumbrances. Didn't even make a search to find out. He assumed that it was free and clear.
With respect to the size, is there any evidence in the record that if he had considered the size, he actually would have come up with a lower value? How could considering a larger area result in a lower value?
Well, Justice Heck, that's a very good question. To answer the first part first, there is evidence to the extent that on cross-examination, Mr. Norwood said that it could have had an effect on his determination of value, but that he didn't consider the larger entire tract, so he didn't know how it would affect it. Our own Court of Appeals in this case, in Tyler, acknowledged the generally accepted appraisal notion that the size of the property is a very important element in determining the fair market value. And in particular, in this case, it is our opinion that whether or not a parcel that is subject to a tax protest is the part of a larger tract is something that must be taken into consideration because it is a characteristic of that tract that could affect its fair market value. And to out of hand did not take that in consideration, failed to comply with 2301D.
But it could affect it either way. It could make it more valuable or less valuable.
That is quite possible. But it is a generally accepted notion, I believe, that the sum of the parts is usually greater than the whole in terms of appraisal technique. So therefore it is by natural and logical progression, we assume that the larger tract would be would have a less value than the sum of its whole parts.
But for it to have any impact on this tract, it would have to have a negative value, wouldn't it? It'd actually have to pull down the value of the whole tract.
Well, not necessarily. First of all, I have to be candid with you. We don't know, and it's really not our argument here today, as to whether or not if he had considered it, it would result in would reduce his opinion of value. We're saying that because he failed to take it into consideration, he violated 2301B, and because the court accepted and relied upon that, it committed reversible error. And then we need to go back to the trial court and try the case under circumstances in which are in compliance with 2301B.
Isn't it true, though, that the larger the tract, normally the lower value per acre because the smaller number of buyers that are capable of acquiring?
Absolutely. That's one of the reasons why the size is an important factor. And there, we submit to you that varying portions of a larger tract have differing values, but if you appraise the large tract as a whole rather than as a sum of its parts, that the per acre or per unit value is going to be less than that is if you just appraise the most valuable portion.
Particularly if all the parts are incumbent.
Absolutely.
Now, are you saying on a large tract like this that the appraiser has to set a value based upon what a willing purchaser would pay for that entire tract, not for...
That's absolutely correct, Justice Phillips. That's what we're saying. With respect to this, it's important that we talked about the size, and we need to also talk briefly about the existence of the leases to its shareholders as being encumbrances. We see that even in the Court of Appeals, they acknowledge the matter of relatively first impression that leases can become encumbrances on the marketability of property which affect its fair market value, even and irrespective of the amount of rental received from those leases. Whether they're market leases or non-market leases is irrelevant. The fact of the matter is that their mere existence constitutes an encumbrance which can affect the ability of the buyer to use the property. Therefore, it necessarily will affect the market value of that property. That notion has been adopted and set forth in the relatively recent case of Tarrant County Appraisal District versus Colonial Country Club, which the court will remember rehearing on which was recently denied and writ was denied in late 1989. And in that case, the Court of Appeals determined that a self-imposed restrictive covenant, even though it wasn't an arm's length transaction and even though it wasn't permanently binding, a self-imposed restrictive covenant written by a property owner has the effect of creating an encumbrance. And that's what we say these leases are. Now, where do we get the authority for the notion that if you violate 2301B, that it constitutes reversible error? Your Honors, we submit to you that a very recent case just handed down from the Fort Worth Court of Appeals in December of 1989, and therefore it wasn't cited in either one of our briefs, is attached under tab number 6 to your handout, and that is the case of Haney versus Cook County Tax Appraisal District, found 782 Southwest 2nd 349. It's a no-writ case. The opinion was written by Judge Keltner. Essentially what that says is that when taxing authorities, not your attention to page 352, that where taxing authorities appraisal expert at trial is shown to have not appraised the property based on the individual characteristics that affects that property's market value as is dictated by 2301B, that in accepting and approving the taxing authority's valuation, the trial court erred. Now, that case involves a situation very quickly where there was a residence that was fairly well run down by appearance from the outside, but it wasn't anything terribly unusual. On the inside, however, it was obvious that it was a shambles. It was virtually uninhabitable. The slab was cracked. There was termite damage. There was water damage. The commodes in the laboratories had fallen through the floor. It was an absolute mess. Well, the appraisal district went by, and by virtue of external inspection and the application of its residential schedule, applied a market value on that property just as it did all the other residences in Cook County.
Did they do on-site inspection?
They drove. My understanding is, Your Honor, that they drove by and saw it from the exterior. They did not do an interior inspection. That was clear.
Did they even go on the premises?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Call it a windshield inspection.
Yeah. In that case, the taxpayer protested. On the trial of the case, the taxing authorities put on the same evidence. They took their appraisal cards that it had the measurements of the house on them, and they applied their mass appraisal schedule to it, and it was determined that it was clear that this appraisal did not constitute compliance with 2301B because it failed to take into consideration the fact that it was uninhabitable. I mean, the place was a shambles. The trial court, however, accepted the mass appraisal technique utilized by the taxing authorities. The Court of Appeals determined that that was reversible error. And more importantly, perhaps, it determined that the taxing authorities have a duty to establish market value in a trial de novo brought to contest their initial appraisal, and that appraisal, that duty to establish market value requires compliance with 2301B. We submit to you, Your Honors, that that was not done by the Gregg County Appraisal District, and we would ask that you grant point of error number one.
Time has expired for petitioner. If both sides want 5 more minutes, we'll grant it.
I don't particularly need it, Your Honor, but I certainly, of course, like it.
Your Honor, we apparently had a miscommunication, and it would greatly appreciate your indulgence for several more minutes for Mr. Kilgarlin.
Any objections to that? All right, we will then give each side 25 minutes to present argument. May proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. Next time I appear here, I'm going to arrange to speak first. The second point of error is much smaller, but in the event of remand, it's something that I hope that Your Honors will deal with, and that is the authority of the district court to increase the valuation placed on the property by the Appraisal Review Board. In this case, for the tax year 1982, Judge Starr increased the evaluation that had been set by the Appraisal Review Board by $7 million. The Court of Appeals, in its opinion, and I'm quoting now from page 959, acknowledges that the statutes do not specifically state that the district court, in deciding an appeal from the Appraisal Review Board's decision, may increase as well as decrease the appraised value found by the Appraisal Review Board. What the Court of Appeals attempts to do then is to look at legislative history and say from this they glean the intent to allow the district court to increase the value as well as to decrease it. I want to read this language. However, the legislature directs the district court to fix the appraised value of property in accordance with the requirements of law. And I want you to remember that language, fix the appraised value, because the whole pivotal bill concept came out of a 1976 Property Study Commission report. And the tax reform was enacted in two separate sessions, 1977 and 1979. In 1977, Senate Bill 714 by Senator Meyer of Tarrant County stated as follows, and this is important, Your Honors, said, and this comes from the House Ways and Means Committee report analysis, committee analysis on Senate Bill 714, says it authorizes the courts to rule on erroneous value. An erroneous value is defined as meaning higher than the owner's sworn rendition filed prior to the board hearing. And that's significant because the House Committee in its report analyzing Senate Bill 714 said that erroneous value, what the district judge could determine, only meant higher value. There's no authority in the legislative intent to give the judge the right to increase value, only to lower value. And here comes a significant language out of the House Ways and Means Committee report. The court shall fix a cash market value. And that's exactly the language that the Tyler Court of Appeals utilizes in saying that legislative history, and yet legislative history is to the contrary. Senator Meyer in 1979, when offering an amendment, says 2 years ago we passed Senate Bill 714. And he says this bill changes that present law. And we're talking about the Pivoteau Bill that was enacted in 79. This amendment I'm proposing merely adds a new section, and that section would then provide an appeal strictly upon the basis of a contest upon the value. Now, it doesn't say it may raise the value $1. There is no authority, Your Honors, for the district court to increase the evaluation that's been set by the appraisal review board.
Even if the appraiser appeals.
I submit to Your Honor, even if the appraiser appeals. But should the appraiser appeal, then there are certain procedural requirements that were not met in this case. And if you look to Article 40, Section 42.02 of the Property Tax Code, you will see that those procedural requirements are there. In this case, there was no notice given to the taxpayer of intent to seek an increase. In this case, there was no statutory compliance with the 45-day petition into the district court. None of the procedural requirements were met to protect the taxpayers. Your Honors, let me ask you to envision the chilling effect it will have upon taxpayers seeking relief if we allow a district court to increase the evaluation. What you're going to do is to chill taxpayers' desire. I ask you to read Bolero Transmission for the legislative history behind the bill. The Pivoteau Bill was clearly designed to make fair the law in respect to taxpayers' rights. Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear oral argument from respondents. Time has been increased to 25 minutes.
May it please the court, Mr. Arnold, Muir, Mr. Arnold,
please. May it please the court. I'm Doug Muir, here on behalf of Gregg County Appraisal District and Gregg County Appraisal Review Board. Wish to point out just sort of a procedural matter in the beginning. There's been some reference to a handout to the court that I have not been given, so I'm not really familiar with what the court has before it this morning that has been presented. So in asking your questions, if you'll take that in mind, and I would certainly appreciate a copy, at least at the conclusion of my argument.
Excuse me, we apologize. We thought that that had been done.
I must confess also to the court that I've been involved in property tax representation litigation for 17 years, and I've been involved in this case for some 9 years. And even as I stand before this court today, I still don't understand what it is they're talking about. And I certainly would appreciate any questions from the court that would help Gregg County Appraisal District better understand exactly what the issues are in this case, at least as Cherokee Water Company wants to make them, because let's say what the case is not. There is no dispute that we're dealing with some of the most valuable residential property in Gregg County. It is a gorgeous and very exceedingly valuable residential subdivision. There's no dispute about that. Indeed, there Cherokee Water Company doesn't even own all of the land around the lake. There are sales around the lake of tracts of land that garner $37,000 an acre that are in the record. There's a comparable sale on the lake. There's no dispute that the bundle of rights of lakefront property there is exceedingly valuable, and there's no dispute about that.
The Cherokee doesn't own all of the lakefront?
That's correct, Your Honor. And indeed, and when I say 37, there's comparable sales in the record. For example, there's one at $37,000 an acre in 1983 on acreage on the lake. That would be a tract not owned by Cherokee Water Company and no access to the lake, but merely have the view of it, say. This is exceedingly valuable residential land. There's no dispute about that.
What's the basis of the joint taxing of certain properties in Rusk County by Gregg and Rusk? Is there a contract between the two counties?
No, Your Honor. The rule of property tax law is, under the property tax code, is that when a school district is a county line school district and may exist in more than one county, that school district can elect which county will value it. And so it only values it for purposes of the Kilgore Independent School District, not for purposes of Kilgore County, for example. So there's no real dispute in this case about what that total bundle of rights in real property that is to be valued as defined in the property tax code as it defines real property, the various bundle of rights. If you really have, and the reason this issue isn't addressed very clearly by Cherokee Water Company is because they don't want the right hand paying taxes any more than the left hand. The shareholders own all the leasehold rights in the property, and on an inside transaction, when the corporation owns the fee subject to these leases, and so they don't want to make it clear because they're not talking about a case where all of a sudden now you go and tax the shareholders if that were permissible, and I'm going to say that that's not permissible under the tax structure.
Mr. Eichhardt said that shareholders pay taxes on the improvements to this property.
Only on the improvements. That's correct, Your Honor. And those aren't an issue here. Those are considered personal property under the terms of the lease, and those are assessed and taxes paid on that. We're merely talking about the land.
Do these shares have a market value that is...
Pardon me?
Do these shares trade with a market value?
That's not in the record, and I'm not, you know... And we're not talking about valuing shares of stock, and that's not at issue here, and so there wasn't any evidence on that or any testimony presented on that. What's at issue
is... those lakefront houses out there that's on Cherokee property, and the owner wanted to sell it to me. He just sells his leasehold interest. Is that right?
That's correct.
Do I then go have to buy a share in the Cherokee Corporation?
I understand that's the way they have their rules structured, yes, Your Honor.
So you buy two things if you move in. You buy a share in the whole property, you buy a share in the company, mm-hmm. and then you buy the interest of the leasehold.
Right. And if you were focusing on that, which we're not.
Sorry?
I said if you were focusing on that valuation issue, which we are not. Okay. We're not attempting in the context of this lawsuit to value what each individual lot owner might sell his property for example.
Well, these leases are for a very long term, I see.
Well, they're one. That's somewhat in dispute, too. They're one-year leases.
Subject. Right to renewal,
Pardon me?
There's an automatic right to renewal?
It could be arguably construed that way. It could arguably can be construed the other, too. These are...
you characterize that in your brief as a sweetheart deal.
Sure, because there's no fixed amount of rent. And see, there's another thing that takes it out of the umbrella of a case, for example, that you'd be looking at some non-economic lease. The owner, Cherokee Water Company, can put that rent anywhere it wants to. Indeed, if it were to sell the property, which it could do, whoever would buy it could put, what, even if you assume it's a long-term lease, can put whatever rental they want to in there.
You mean the purchaser determines the rental price?
That's correct. Well, the purchaser or Cherokee Water Company, whoever owns the property, that's right. That's the term of the lease. The lease does not only fixes a nominal rental for maintenance purposes, but it's done year by year. And the lease terms say that that Cherokee Water Company, the owner, can change that figure annually. So it can change that number whatever it wants to. That's not.
But it applies to everyone equally. Except somebody that has a particularly desirable location pays on the basis of front foot the same as someone who has a less desirable.
Sure. That could be changed annually if you wanted to. You can do anything you want. I mean, the lease itself is not an encumbrance in that regard because the owner, in this case being Cherokee Water Company or whoever bought from Cherokee Water Company, could modify each individual lease and put any amount they wanted to in the rental. That's not fixed except for a 12-month period. And that's why the trial court found and the Court of Appeals found, as a matter of fact, and is that they were not a substantial encumbrance on the property that would affect the market value if anybody were going to buy that property. The 2301, which was up here, is merely a valuation section of the property tax code. It tells how property is to be valued. It doesn't tell you who it's to be valued to. And that's why I make the point that there's no question that the entire bundle of rights, the real property rights in this property, are very valuable, and they're to be appraised according to 2301 at generally accepted appraisal techniques. But that doesn't tell you what estate is to be appraised. It doesn't tell you whether you appraise the leased fee estate, possessory estate. It just tells you whatever estate you're going to appraise, you're going to appraise it based on generally accepted appraisal techniques. You look elsewhere in the code to find who property is to be taxed to, assessed to, or listed to, whatever phrase might be in the code context, it's listed. And when you have, for example, as you do in this case, possessory interest, 2506 of the code says property encumbered by a leasehold or other possessory interest is to be listed in the name of the owner of the property so encumbered. So the appraisal district, what we're talking about is a matter of tax policy and tax administration. And the tax policy and tax administration of this state has been well established for over 100 years. That leaseholds of states, unless specifically made taxable by the tax law, are not taxed separately, but rather are taxed in the total value of the property to the owner, record owner of the property. That is, in my opinion, the proper construction of the code. But even if one were to say, well, wait a minute, maybe we ought to do that, you still don't get over the hurdle that they would have in this case in 2504 of the property tax code dealing with separate estates or interests. If they want to suggest, for example, that a leasehold estate should somehow be valued separately and taxed separately, 2504 says to be entitled to that, it must be in a duly executed and recorded instrument of title. Well, the evidence in this case is the leases are not recorded in non-recordable form. That's not an issue in this case. It never was.
There's no dispute that there are leases. Isn't that correct?
There's no dispute that there are leases. That's correct.
It just seems to me that if I owned a 500-acre tract of land and I wanted to lease it out in 10-acre tract, that when you came to appraise my property, suppose I lease it out in 50 10-acre tracts. Nothing is built on. And the appraiser comes out to appraise it. He would certainly want to appraise my whole 500 acres in one tract, wouldn't he? He wouldn't want to go out there and try to figure out where each of the 10-acre tracts are. Because really, it wouldn't make any difference.
He would appraise whatever he was asked to appraise. That is, if you wanted him to appraise the 500, he would appraise the 500. It would depend on what was the subject property of the appraisal assignment.
No, but isn't that what Cherokee Water District did?
No, Your Honor, because the subject property in this case was defined by their pleading. That was the subject property that they appealed from the Appraisal Review Board, and they asked the court to fix the value on. If the court's going to be asked to fix the value on a defined amount of property by a pleading, it has to know what the value of that property that it is going to fix the value of. And that gets defined by the plaintiff when he defines what property it is that he wants the court to fix the value on. So when you go and ask your appraiser, in this case an MAI appraiser, what is the value of this 646 acres, or what is the value of this 2,311 acres, or whatever, that they have asked the court to fix the value of?
Well, let's take it one step back, man. The very question is what the appraisal district asked this appraiser to fix the value on, and was that legal under the statute?
Oh, I see what you're saying. The question earlier that the Chief Justice...
We're not into the trial.
Right.
We're back at the
Chief
Review Board.
Is this in reference to your question earlier, where you required to value the whole tract?
Well, I guess it's
yeah. And of course, the answer to that is no, because that would not be in conformity with either the definition of market value contained in the code or with 2301 of the code of using generally accepted appraisal techniques. Because if I've got a large tract of property, under the definition section of market value, it requires that both the seller and purchaser seek to maximize their gains in a transaction. If I've got a large tract that will only bring less by selling it as a whole, or I can divide it up and sell it for more, then I'm going to sell it for more. And any buyer would know that it could be divided up and sold by more. And you analyze it with generally appraisal techniques to ascertain what is the maximum amount and how you would end up going about selling it.
On large lot, you can come by and say, well, gee, if you want to sell your front yard, build some condos and need more money, so we're going to up the valuation of this property.
Are you saying that if I had a working cattle ranch and had good frontage and good trees, and in other words, it's just what someone from Houston or Dallas would want, that for appraisal purposes, the appraiser should value it as if it were being sold in 25-acre tracts?
No.
Because that would be the best use
What I'm submitting to the court is that the appraiser would appraise it based on its highest and best use and what it would sell for in the marketplace.
I don't see your cases in any cases in either brief on this, unless I just missed them.
I don't think it was an issue, to be quite. I don't think it was drawn as an issue by them or anything else. And as a matter of fact, Norwood did take into consideration the size of this. It's just not correct what they say, is they didn't take into consideration the size or what the property surrounding it, as you would in any appraisal of property. You have to take into consideration the location of property and what's it around it and what's it part of and these sort of features. But to more fully answer the other question, though, is that if you have a piece of a ranch, for example, that the highest and best use would be for residential subdivision purposes, it's going to be appraised for market purposes at that highest and best use, not at its value for ranch purposes, for example. That's one of the reasons we have the special appraisal provisions on open space land and farmland.
So you have the agricultural exemption statute.
Right, it's not an exemption, it's a special valuation statute. Yeah, you can develop a value for farm or ranch purposes and a value for market purposes. That is, what it would sell for on the open market at its highest and best use. What I'd like to make clear, if I could, is the fact that what this is about is whether... See, we have the only appraiser that appraised the full bundle of real property rights on the property in question. And we submit we did comply, and our appraiser did comply, and the trial court so found, and so did the Court of Appeals, with 2301 and using generally accepted appraisal techniques on valuing that property. What has to be being said by them is that, wait a minute, maybe you shouldn't value all of the property rights to Cherokee Water Company, I guess ostensibly meaning maybe they should be taxed to somebody else, because we're not talking about property then escaping taxation. And like I say, the only things they point out, for example, is, well, how about these leases? Well, the long-standing law in Texas, and it hadn't been changed by the property tax code, is that possessory interests are subsumed within the value of the fee to be taxed to the owner of the property. And that hasn't changed. The water sales contract, nowhere in that contract do they show how that would anywise be incompatible with the highest and best use assumed by our appraiser, which was as residential subdivision. In fact, that's the use that it's being put to. The trial court so found, the Court of Appeals so held.
Did Russ County just have a failure of imagination?
No. Russ County just accepted what they've been rendering for years, and so had Gregg County until about 1981. In fact, we're in a catch-22. There's a 1981 litigation in this case where there was an attempt made to appraise the leaseholders, and Cherokee Water Company then argues, no, the law is you've got to tax it all Cherokee Water. We're just going to get caught in a catch-22 back and forth on this. It's time for this case to come to an end. There's no dispute that there's valuable property out there, and there's no dispute that the school districts out there need the money. And the time has come to an end to put this case to an end and have that money flow to where it can be used. The
But from a tax administration standpoint of the code, well, the terms are defined in Section 104, real property, market value, etc. That's just a definitional section. Chapter 11 tells what property is taxable, which all real property is real property is taxable. Chapter 23, 2301, tells how it is to be appraised. And then Chapter 25 says who it's to be taxed to. And in the instance of possessory interest, they're to be taxed to the owner of the fee. And if it were to be any otherwise, you would have to comply with 2504, which was not complied with in this case, which would have required a recorded instrument. And that would be good tax administration, too. If you're going to have to somehow value every unrecorded leasehold estate in this state, there's not enough money at the appraisal districts to even go about that enterprise. And it's not required under the longstanding precedence of this court, and it wasn't modified by the legislature in the enactment of the property tax code. The
Court of Appeals said a lease of sufficient duration might, like an easement or restrictive covenant, prevent the highest use to which the property might otherwise be devoted, and suggested in that case it should be taken into account. What's your response to that?
My response to that might be the same as maybe to the water contract in the same context, and that is, for example, let's suppose you did have a long-term lease lease this for residential purposes, and an appraiser comes in and says, no, the highest and best use of this property that would maximize its property value would be as a strip mine. We'll drain the lake and strip mine. Well, sure, in that instance, there's a contract that assuming it was binding, assuming it was long term. I'm not going to make those assumptions because I don't think those are the facts in our case. But I think that's what they're talking about, that kind of situation. Same would be true of the water contract. I mean, there's no dispute that they're supplying part of the potable water supply to the city of Longview. If an appraiser came in likewise and said the highest and best use of this property is to drain the lake and to strip mine underneath it and such, no, yeah, that, and if a value would be higher, yeah, that would be a restriction on the situation. Now, we say that they need to point out to us and point out to this court in some regard why these so-called encumbrances that they want to point to have some effect on the market value.
Does the water company have any effective right to terminate the possessory interest of the residents? The lease, or whatever, however it should be characterized.
Without regard to the fact that they're insiders, just putting that issue aside from that.
Well, nobody is so inside, I assume, that they would risk their residence on the good faith of someone else to just let them.
Oh, yeah, well, it is, because it's a closed corporation.
Well, 1,500 stockholders?
Yeah. And by their rules, they control the rules that regulate the lake, and they vote as a group. And even if you did, they would be then the recipients of the money that would flow from that sale. And it's an insider closed corporation that can divvy up however they elect to divvy up, and whatever they make their situation. But no, I don't. You don't necessarily have to read that. You know, the leases could easily be read to say that Cherokee Water Company could terminate them at the end of the year, but certainly they provide that Cherokee Water Company could raise the rent to a level that would could be above market, could be anything, and if you control what the rent will be, your tantamount to ability to terminate a lease as well too.
But you can control your rent because you're a stockholder.
Well. Yeah, you're back into the insider situation. I mean, that's like, you know, I could incorporate, form a corporation and deed my home into that corporation too, and then lease it back to myself at some nominal rent. And am I in the same position saying I've got this long-term lease and I've also got a side agreement with my daughter that she can always have her room and that I will never sell it and on and on. Those aren't legally enforceable restrictions when that owner gets ready to want to sell. And those owners, but
if that's going to be construed to be the types of restrictions that will limit value, we're going to set loose all types of hybrid transactions, contracts between parties not at arm's length on destroying the property tax base. Let me...
Can you respond very briefly to the right of a district court to increase as well as decrease the appraisal district's number?
Yes, Your Honor.
Under what circumstances that can be done?
I think that the property tax code ought to be read. When you're looking at Chapter 41, you look at Chapter 41, which is the administrative appeal section, and Chapter 42, and you read those together, that when a property owner appeals to the court for a trial de novo and is asking that court to fix the market value of property, and the case is to be tried according to the way other cases are to be tried when the issues are presented. That means the issue before the court is what is the market value of that property. And that has been requested. That's requested in the pleadings in this case. Court fixed the market value of that property. Now,
I thought they were asking to lower. They're asking for a reduction. I asked to fix the rate.
No, they actually asked to fix it. They also, surely, if after the fixing it would show a lower number, they also asked that it be lower too. But in the first instance, they asked it to be fixed. In each one of the cases, they asked to be fixed, as indeed that's what the tax code would provide. The court is to, I notice my time is
expiring.
or may I finish my thought? The court is to determine, in 4224, in determining an appeal, the trial court may fix the value if the appraised value is at issue. Appraised value is at issue, it may fix it. Now, the incongruous result you're going to have if you say, the court can now determine what it is that the legal and correct value as required by the law on that property, but my hands are tied on trial de novo to go ahead and implement that value, which Chapter 43 would say, using the same language in Chapter, 4241, the implementation, the chief appraiser shall correct the appraisal roll to reflect the final determination of an appeal. Directly tying back to 4224. I submit that the trial court sits like the ARB sat. The ARB is not merely a judicial body. It sits there to determine, it does hear hearings, but it's also charged under Chapter 41 with the broader responsibility to review and to make sure that all properties are correctly valued and to in accordance with the law. The ARB has that power. Certainly the court has that power sitting in its stead on de novo on fixing that value, and it's just a plain reading of the code. Not only has the Tyler Court reached that conclusion, also the Fort Worth Court of Appeals in Tarrant County versus Colonial, also identical issue is addressed in that case.
What's the
and
point
came up
of,
with the same result.
What's the point of extending a right of appeal to the appraiser if the trial court can render him relief anyway?
The appeal of the appraiser is something
if the appraiser thinks the value is too low and he doesn't like it and wants to appeal it, and he can, then why should the trial court have the power to increase the value without such an appeal?
He doesn't have the automatic legal right to appeal. He may secure permission from the board to do so, but he's not just given the automatic right. He's just given the right to participate and to be a party in the case if he so chooses. I submit in conformity with the Code Construction Act that public interest is favored over private interest, and the acts cited by the petitioners have been repealed, and the sections they're talking about, and that the public interest is that when a court has gone through and determined what the correct value according to law is, that the code should not be so construed as to tie the court's hands and not be able to fix what the law would require. Thank you.
Let me ask you one question for you. Is the stock of the corporation being taxed?
No, Your Honor.
Any reason why it's not?
The stock?
Yeah.
because that would be an intangible property, and intangible personal property is not taxable.
Any other questions? Yeah, counsel, there was a new case cited that's not in the brief in tab 6, Haney versus Cook County, and you may want to respond supplemental brief if you care to as to why this case is.
I also got an amicus brief just this Monday, and I would request the court if I could file a supplemental or post submission and respond to some of the matters that we have. Thank you.
10 days be sufficient?
I believe so, Your Honor. Yes.
May it please the court, I'm going to take a sharp moment to respond to Mr. Muir's comments on point of error number 2, and then I'm going to turn it back to Mr. Eichert. Mr. Muir refers to two cases, one Colonial Country Club and the other Rubbermaid, as authority for the district judge being able to set. Let me tell you how bad law is made. I want to read to you from the most recent case, Colonial Country Club. Furthermore, Rubbermaid explicitly states that an appraisal authority is not bound by the appraisal roll value in contesting the market value of the property. See Rubbermaid. Rubbermaid. The court had the authority to weigh the evidence and set the market value at any amount between the highest and lowest values expressed by the witnesses. Maxey versus Texas Commerce Bank of Lubbock. Maxey. The answer to special issue number 3 was well within the range of values presented in evidence. The jury had the right to weigh the evidence and set the total value at any amount between the highest and lowest value expressed by witnesses. Centerville Independent School District of Leon County versus Wingfield. Now back to Centerville. As sole judge of the credibility of the witnesses and the weight to be given to the testimony, the jury had the right to set the value of the 19.4-acre tract immediately prior to the taking, as it did at any amount between the highest and the lowest expressed by the witnesses. You see what we've done? We have taken a condemnation case where the jury has the right to select the value, and by progression of appellate court opinions, we now have it down that the district judge can increase the valuation in a property tax case. Now, I submit to you, do not accept Colonial and Rubbermaid as authority, as Mr. Muir has argued. Now, I turn it over to Mr. Eichert.
First, let me address specifically several questions that were asked by Judge Hightower. First of all, the shares are traded along with the shares of stock. Let me start along with the leasehold interest. Actually, what happens is there's a fairly large market of shares sold via ads in the newspaper and by real estate brokers, just as if they were selling the fee hold, the fee estate by itself. And when you sell the share of stock, then you get the leasehold interest that is attached to it. With respect to the notion that the...
But that share is not taxed, at least
on No, Your Honor, it's not. There is a express statutory provision which prohibits taxing of intangible personal property.
And there are no unattached shares? There's not a block of shares out there?
There is one share of stock which is held in the company's treasury, Your Honor. There are 1,499 shares outstanding.
And
yes, sir. Well, that's not exactly correct because there are 1,499, but they're held by less than 1,499 individuals because some own more than one share. I would also like to address the argument of whether or not the Cherokee Water Company could sell the property. I mean, it becomes from the rather facile analysis that respondents make, I think, has a certain amount of appeal, but it has no practical basis. The fact of the matter is shareholders aren't going to allow the sale of their property where they have the leasehold interest and have built homes on them. And not only that, there must be some sense of perpetual ownership here because a number of financial institutions in and around Longview have loan construction and purchase money financing on a regular basis to construct these residences and for the purchase of the leasehold estates with the improvements on them. These things trade all the time. These are, for all practical purposes, perpetual leases which constitute encumbrances on the property. I am impressed, however, most by the petitioner's candor, to be honest with you.
First of all, in response to Judge Ray's question, he says that the appraiser would appraise what he was asked to appraise. Well, that's exactly right. He appraised what he was asked to appraise. And we submit to you that the pleadings in this case do not define the property which should be appraised any more than in a situation such as was addressed by this court in Polk County versus Tenneco, where a segment of a pipeline is the subject of a tax case, that the taxpayer should appraise the pipeline segment standing alone. This court said the proper way to appraise that property was to appraise the entire unit, the entire pipeline system, and allocate a portion down to the relevant dispute. That's exactly what we're saying should be the case in this instance. But most important of what the respondent said was indicated that back in 1981 they tried to tax the leaseholds, but they couldn't do it. And you know why they couldn't do it? Because it was illegal. And we filed a lawsuit, and that really frustrated them. So now, in 1982, they try to go about it from another standpoint. They hire an appraiser who will appraise a fictional property, a property that doesn't exist, but will arrive at the value they want.
Is it true that if you took a particular residence on a Cherokee Water Company property, and an identical resident, say, across the street, but not on that property, that the taxes due on the water company's property, payable by whomever, would be substantially less than the taxes due on the property across the street?
That's not necessarily correct, Judge Heck. The fact of the matter is that it does matter who pays them, it seems to me, in this instance. But we're saying that we believe there is a bundle of rights which is a total value, and that should be taken into consideration, and certainly the law requires the house across the street to be valued at the same value as our house. We're not saying it doesn't, and the taxes should be the same.
But following your bundle, you shouldn't owe less tax on gold just because you wrap it in straw, should you?
No, you should not.
But you're claiming that unless I meant it's not very fundamental, that the improvements here are not owned by you and should not be considered by the appraiser.
No, we're saying that no, that's not exactly what we're saying.
So that's because you get taxed separately.
Yeah. Well, we are saying that. There are two different things at play here, Justice Phillips. One is taxes, and the other is the way the property is appraised. And we're saying that the appraisal is dictated by 2301, and 2301 requires that you take into consideration the individual characteristics of the property that affect its market value. The existence of a house on a tract of land affects its marketability, because when you buy it, if you don't own the house, you've got to move it or do something with it. And we feel like, because of that, not necessarily to determine who pays what tax and how much the tax is, but surely for compliance with 2301 and for generally accepted appraisal methodology, you have to consider the existence of that house. You have to consider the existence of the lease.
But I assume when the individual shareholders go to have this property tax, they say you've got to consider the house apart from the land it sits on, or the view that we're valuing it solely in terms of wood and nail.
I don't know whether I assume that's an accurate assumption, Your Honor. It's not an issue.
Then these two parts don't add up to anywhere near the amount that the fellow that owns a fee simple title on the lake
could be. Perhaps. But the fact is, the person who owns the fee simple title on the lake, that is, by the way, there's only 20 acres on the lake that are not owned by Cherokee Water Company, and that one transaction that he was talking about, which he called a comparable at $37,000, clearly it was not encumbered by any of these things. It wasn't encumbered by a lease, it wasn't encumbered by improvements, and that's why we're saying that value could be higher. Now, let me just make a brief analogy, and that is a situation where, say, there is a highway that runs across a bridge on a portion of the property, and it's on your map, you'll be able to see it. And I submit to you that if the The governmental authorities came in to widen that highway and attempted by condemnation to take a portion of the lakefront property. And Cherokee Water Company, the owner of that lakefront property, went into the commissioner's court and said, we're just going to submit this appraisal of these two little lakefront lots here, and we're going to submit them to you based on the fact that they are their highest and best use is for residential recreational use on a lakefront, then that would be summarily rejected by the condemning authorities. They would require that the entire 7,100-acre tract be appraised for the purposes of condemnation, and we're asking for the same treatment with respect to tax.
One more question.
Yes, sir.
If the appraiser had said, now I've got to appraise the value of this lake, and the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to go around and I'm going to appraise each one of these lakefront lots and put a separate value on each one, and then I'm going to consider that that lakefront lot extends to the middle of the lake. That way I'm going to get the whole lake and get all the
lots. Yes,
sir. And then add all that up and say this is the value of the whole lake, wouldn't that have been all right? That's what I'm doing. Instead of saying, I'm going to appraise the lakefront here, but I'm not going to put any value over here in the water. I think you said, I'm just going to appraise this lakefront as if that leasehold interest goes all the way to the center of the lake.
Well, Judge Hightower, that may be one way to appraise it, but one thing that you have to understand is, first of all, the lake and the lakefront lots only cover about 4,000 acres of the 7,100. So there's a lot of land which is away from the lake, which is there to protect the watershed from pollution.
And it's also owned by Cherokee.
And it's also owned by Cherokee.
In
Russ County, it's appraised all together as one unit. Russ County appraises the entire unit and applies its rural land schedule based on comparable sales to it. The Gregg County Appraisal District did not appraise it that way. And whether or not Russ County is very creative or not, I don't know, but at least they complied with the law.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first call, and the court will now take a brief recess.